This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This weekend, the hashtag Where Are the Children was all over social media, and it's a story we reported on a few weeks ago here at The Takeaway. But we need to make some clear points. There are actually two stories that have to be broken down. The first is about 7,000 children who came to the United States without their parents. Many of them were fleeing drug cartels, gang violence, and domestic abuse, and coming from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Officials at the Health and Human Services Department, which oversees refugee resettlement, testified before a Senate subcommittee earlier this year that they had placed 6,000 of those kids with sponsors. 28 ran away, 52 were living with a non-sponsor, and 5 were removed from the country. But those officials also said that they were unable to account for roughly 1,500 of those kids, meaning the agency, in their follow-up calls, said they couldn't determine where they were. Then, in a separate story, you have this new policy by the Trump administration.
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law. If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
Under this new policy, hundreds of undocumented migrant children, largely from Central America and the southern U.S.-Mexico border, have already been separated from their parents. And in some instances, the parents are given no information about where their child is. Lee Gelernt is a deputy director at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Lee, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we have two separate stories here. It's really critical that we define what these two stories are. Are any of these children actually missing?
Right now, we don't have any solid evidence of that. What we have is evidence that the sponsors simply don't want to talk to the Trump administration. So the missing children thing is a little bit misleading in that the children are not just simply walking around missing. It's more likely that their sponsors just don't want to talk to the Trump administration.
Now, let's say some of these children aren't with sponsors. I mean, what is the U.S. government's responsibility if kids come across the border unaccompanied?
Right. We absolutely have a responsibility to these children legally and morally. But right now, what we're concerned about is that people misunderstand the process. There is a strong vetting process to make sure that kids are put with a sponsor that's going to take care of them. That's happening. We'd hate to see misinformation go out that then allows the Trump administration to say, well, we're going to keep holding the kids for months and months and months and not release them to sponsors on the false assumption that the kids are actually missing.
Now, this, again, is a separate group of kids that is not the kids that we're talking about under this new guidance from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And Sessions, we heard earlier, is basically saying that children who are brought across the border will be separated from their parents. Is this a new policy or is this a strengthening of former policy?
No, it's absolutely unprecedented. The systematic separation of parents and children, including children 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, is absolutely unprecedented. And I think there's two critical points in response to what the Attorney General and Secretary Nielsen are saying. Their soundbite is, if you don't want your children taken away from you, don't cross the border illegally. Two questions are never asked as follow-ups to the Attorney General and the Secretary. One is, you say if you don't want your child taken away, don't cross the border illegally, present yourself at a port of entry. Well, the ACLU has a lawsuit now challenging family separation that's going to be decided any day. It shows that many, many parents are presenting themselves at a port of entry legally, asking for asylum, and still having their child taken away from them. Our lead plaintiff is a Congolese mom who presented herself at a port of entry with her then 6-year-old daughter. After 4 days, the daughter was ripped away from her. The mother could hear the daughter in the next room begging, pleading, please don't take me away from my mommy. Please don't take me away from my mommy. She was sent to Chicago. The mother was kept in San Diego for 4 months. The mother was given no information about why the little child was taken. This is a parent, like many other parents, who presented themselves at a port of entry. So it's simply not true that you can avoid having your child taken from you if you present at a port of entry. The second critical point that no one ever asked the Attorney General or Secretary Nielsen is, well, what happens when the parent gets out of jail after the few days for the misdemeanor? Is the child returned? And the answer is no. Our other named plaintiff goes by Miss C. She crossed the border with her son, fleeing domestic violence in Brazil, crossed the border, got time served for the misdemeanor. Her child was taken away and sent to Chicago. She was in Texas. She was released from criminal jail. It's been more than 7 months since she was released from criminal jail and still has not gotten her child back.
Do we know how much this is costing Americans, the taxpayer?
That's a very good question. We are in the process, I think, of calculating how much it will cost. But ultimately, the fundamental question has to be the sort of humanity of what's going on. I think that if policymakers could sit in one of those rooms and see these little kids, 3, 4, 5 years old, begging not to be taken away from their parents, it would lend a real human dimension to the debate. Right now, I fear that the debate over immigration has gotten very abstract, and people need to see these little kids begging not to be taken away from their parents to sort of have a full understanding of what this policy is doing.
I want to also talk about the images that were also making the rounds this weekend along with the hashtag. It was quickly pointed out, as social media tends to correct itself, that those were images. The images I'm referring to are children sleeping in cages on the floor with a small mat. It turns out that these images were, in fact, from the Obama administration, which also had very strict policies. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Obama administration's role and legacy was with this?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you asked that because I think, again, they're separate stories. And so we have always been troubled by the way Customs and Border Patrol, CBP, treats children. The difference, though, is that the Obama administration, nor any other administration, has ever engaged in the separation of children. So it takes it to a whole new level. The Obama administration was not systematically separating children. Was CBP abusing children during that period? Yes, we've always been concerned about CBP abuse. But what's new and shouldn't be confused is the Trump administration of separating children.
Lee Gelernt is a deputy director at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me and shining a light on this important issue.
The practice of separating children from their parents in the United States is not new, but one historian says that in order to understand what's happening today, we need to understand our past. And to help us take this necessary look back, we are joined by Martha Jones. She's the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Jones, welcome.
Hi, Tanzina.
As the outrage over immigrant children being separated from their families grew louder, you decided to come in with some history about the past. Tell us why. What was missing?
I woke up Saturday morning with a feeling that people were somewhat naive in their reactions to the proposition that the United States would separate parents and children as a policy matter. As a historian, I knew that those sorts of practices were more American than we might think.
And when we say they're more American, how far back do they go?
Well, they certainly go back as far as the early 19th century, which is to say the institution of slavery is a vivid example of a long period during which, on the auction block, literally and metaphorically, parents were separated from children by slaveholders, but with the authority of the state, with the protection of the state behind them.
Do we know enough about this in our history classes? Are we taught the impact of this?
Well, one of the things that has been interesting to me is how surprised people are to learn about this dimension of the enslaved experience. We emphasize the cruelty of slavery as physical punishment, for example, as forced labor. And less often, I think, do we appreciate the ways in which enslaved people indeed are making families and building communities and feel at tremendous risk always of having those relationships disrupted. One of the most moving pieces of evidence are the hundreds, really thousands, of newspaper ads that former slaves place after emancipation in 1865. Historian Heather Ann Williams has written about these advertisements in which parents and children, siblings, spouses place advertisements in local newspapers searching for people that they've been separated from even for decades. To me, the most arresting detail in Williams' study is that these ads continue to appear in the newspapers until 1902. And so here we have this vivid sense of the depth of family ties and the trauma, if you will, of having been separated involuntarily, violently, and in many cases irrevocably from one's family.
And there also is the example of Indian boarding schools, correct?
Yes. So these are institutions, some of which date back all the way to the 1840s, and some of which continued into the 21st century, where by coercion, by force, by subterfuge, Native parents were persuaded to give over their children to state-run institutions. These were institutions that were intending to, if you will, assimilate, anglicize Native peoples into another version or vision of Americans. And we have today even survivors of these institutions and their really arresting testimony about the sort of cruelty, the inhumanity to which they were subjected.
But Professor, this also seems to go against directly against what the United States is supposed to stand for in many ways, particularly now, right, with this idea of family and what's important. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, I'm not sure we can reconcile them, and I think that's part of what the outrage that we're hearing from many Americans is rooted in. How is it that we are a nation, on the one hand, that has built itself on the family as a social institution, as an intimate institution, the family as an economic institution?
But do we only support the family, white families in this country? Is that the message that we're getting?
I would say oftentimes this is a story that breaks down along racial lines, and families of color have been on the other side of this equation. But I've just read a new book by historian Hidetaka Hirota called Expelling the Poor. And what Hirota tells us is that even for Irish immigrants in the early part of the 19th century, in those stories also, the state was responsible for separating families from children.
Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor, a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, and her forthcoming book is called Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Professor Jones, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's the ninth day of a truck driver strike in Brazil that is bringing that country to an economic standstill. Truck drivers have been protesting sharp increases in fuel costs, and they've been blocking highways, and they've recently been joined by Uber, van, and bus drivers. Brazilian President Michel Temer offered concessions this weekend, but truck drivers have yet to return to work. As of today, 8 airports remain closed due to fuel shortages, and people on the ground are feeling the impact. With trucks not making deliveries, some supermarkets are limiting how much customers can buy. Joining us now is Zoe Sullivan, a freelance reporter based in Brazil. Zoe, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Tanzina.
Hi. So tell us what the truck drivers are protesting and what people are feeling on the ground.
Sure. The strike started last Monday, and the impetus for it was that the price of diesel, which is the fuel for trucks, has increased something like 225 times over the past year, with the Temer government, which came to power after Dilma Rousseff's impeachment. The person who took over Petrobras, which is the state-run oil company, basically changed the pricing policy and tied the price of oil to international oil prices. Those prices have been going up. The real has been losing value with respect to the dollar. Brazil is importing about 80% of its diesel from the United States. And so it just is a recipe for major price increases.
And President Temer initially took a hardline stance on the strike, but this weekend offered some concessions. Truck drivers were not very responsive from what we understand, right?
That's right. And the Temer government had advance notice of this. I mean, the truckers' unions and organizations reached out to him about a week before the blockades began, saying that they were going to do this, and the government didn't do anything. So he has offered concessions. He's offered to reduce the price of diesel by 46 cents a gallon and to hold that price for 60 days, which would cost the country $3.6 billion. But there are still 500 different blockade points around the country. And one of the things that's also happening is many of the truckers are supporting a military intervention and basically the, you know, the removal of this government. And they're getting a lot of popular support as well.
But they're also being inconvenienced, right? We mentioned earlier in the segment, supermarkets are sort of limiting what people can get. Airports are shut down. What other ways are Brazilians being impacted by this?
Yes, people are absolutely being inconvenienced. People, you know, are limiting their movements as much as possible because public transportation has been reduced to, you know, skeleton service. Many gas stations are closed, so if you have a car, you can't fuel it up. I mean, those are the big things. Schools have been closed. Here in Recife, the public government was closed on Friday. There's confusion about what's going on as well, in part because, you know, the government has made various offers over the past of the last week. And regardless of the offers, the blockades are continuing.
And how do you expect this to impact politics?
I mean, I think that's the $30 million question right now. What I see happening with this is the strikers are asking for a military intervention. And this situation is very similar to what happened in 1964 when the military overthrew the government and basically began what was a more than 20-year dictatorship. So it's a tricky situation right now. There are elections that are supposed to happen in October. People are not sure if this situation will justify canceling the elections. Former President Lula is in prison on corruption charges right now. He remains the front runner in the upcoming elections, but it's not likely that he's going to actually be able to run. The person who is in second place is often compared to Donald Trump. He's a former military officer and an apologist for the dictatorship who, you know, some analyses say is basically supporting the truckers because while chaos reigns now, he can run in October promising order.
Zoe Sullivan is a freelance reporter based in Brazil. Thanks, Zoe.
Thank you.
What does a man do?
What is it to be a man?
The notion of what a man should be like.
It's very confusing.
Be a man.
It's not quite what you think it is.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type?
In order to be a man, they've got to separate their hearts from their heads.
There's a part of them crying out for the incorporation of the monster within them.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies and to hear the lamentation of your women.
Most of the violent crimes that happen are not committed by women. Committed by men.
What does it mean to be a man?
It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Men, you have work to do.
Next month, we're going to look closely at what it means to be a man in 2018. And we want to hear from you.
Hi, my name is Joe from Philadelphia. Traditional definitions no longer capture all of masculinity, but I know that men nonetheless impose these upon each other, and women are guilty of imposing images of masculinity upon us as well. So it is something of a struggle, particularly as men grapple with losing their masculine privilege, along with the notions, the clear ideas of what masculinity entails.
How important is masculinity to your identity? Keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or write to us on our Facebook page. When this happens in one of your company stores...
What did they get called for? Because there are two black guys sitting here meeting me?
Yes, I didn't know that.
Well, what did they do? What did they do? Someone tell me what they did.
They didn't do anything. I saw the entire thing.
They didn't. What did they do?
What do you do? That, of course, was the aftermath of an employee calling the police on two black men in a Philadelphia Starbucks on April 12th. Starbucks's answer to the incident is to close 8,000 stores today and provide racial bias training for thousands of its employees. And I've got two people here with me to share their thoughts. Heather McGee is the president of Demos, a progressive think tank, and an advisor to Starbucks on their anti-bias training. And Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University, a former prosecutor, and the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thank you both for joining me.
It's great to be here.
So, Heather, you're advising Starbucks pro bono. What's your philosophy going into this?
Well, Howard Schultz, the chairman and founder of Starbucks, called me a few days after the incident. And, you know, I was as appalled as anybody and certainly as any African-American watching the video. My first memory as a child is of being chased out of a penny candy store with my older brother because a white store manager thought we were going to steal something. So I knew, you know, that this is both a deeply American problem and something that Starbucks needed to deal with. I was frankly surprised that they were so willing to say from the outset, yes, this is an issue of racial bias. I was very surprised when Howard Schultz told me that he had an idea to close all their stores and do some sort of training. And what I said to him was, one, it's really important that this be pro bono. Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative and Sherilyn Eiffel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund were also asked to be advisors at that time. And I said, we have to be completely independent. You're coming outside of the corporate world in order to, you know, ask for some accountability and input and advice from people in the racial justice world. So we need to be on the other side of the line from you on this. And then the second is, this one day, while significant for a workforce that turns over 50 to 60% in a year, part-time workers, I mean, this is not the people who usually get the corporate diversity training, let me put it that way. It has to be just the launch of a multi-phase process that looks at this all quite systemically, even beyond what Starbucks does, to also what Starbucks can use its leverage to influence in terms of the police.
And Heather, you said you were surprised. Paul, were you also surprised at the announcement or the decision that Starbucks made to do this?
I was thrilled that Starbucks is being accountable. It's understanding the issue is not a bad apple barista, but something that's more systemic. Starbucks is doing something that's very dramatic, that's inspiring this conversation. I think it's important that we talk about bias in all of its forms, implicit and explicit. And, you know, if I try to go for my cup of joe this afternoon and I see the stores closed, you know, and people have that experience, I think it redounds not just to the employees of Starbucks, but to the whole country.
And there was, I'm sure you both have seen the social media reaction to this. It's been mixed. I would say there have also been folks who have sort of eye rolling and saying, well, what's one afternoon really going to do? Is this, you know, going to be effective? I mean, what do we know? Is one afternoon enough, Heather?
One afternoon is not enough to erase decades, in most cases, of ingrained stereotypes and negative associations with people of color, with women, with visibly poor people, with people with disabilities. But it is two things. One, it is an essential first step for a company that is now committed to making this the launch of a multi-phase process that's going to get much deeper with its management level employees, with its review and change of its policies and practices, you know, to undergo a racial equity organizational transformation, you really have to look at all aspects of the business. And they're willing to do that this first day is just a start. But I will say for the nearly 200,000 participants of this training, again, who are, you know, working and middle class folks who, many of whom are in college, have not finished their degrees or are not college bound, this 4 to 5 hours of being taught what, you know, to Professor Butler and I might be the basics of bias and stereotypes, where they come from in our history, what political and economic purpose they serve. Being given time to think about your own group identity and to run through scenarios and role playing, sadly, that's quite rare. And in a political climate and a media climate where stereotypes are being trafficked from the highest office of the land as if they are common sense, having a company tell you these stereotypes are actually something that you should divorce yourself from, that you should take a moment and pause when you see yourself making these associations, that you should work as a team to have systems and practices that mitigate not necessarily the bias associations, because that's very hardwired in our minds and it takes a lot of practice to undo them and create new, more positive associations, but certainly to make sure that those stereotypes don't create actions that have negative outcomes for your fellow employees and your customers.
And Heather, you mentioned, I'm curious, these are most of the sort of shop personnel that are going to get these trainings, but what about the highest levels of the organization?
Yeah, that was something that Sherilyn Eiffel and I really wanted to make clear from the beginning. You can't ask these part-time employees to do something that you're not willing to do yourself. And so the Starbucks leadership, the executives, the corporate management, the global leadership, in fact, have been doing work over the past few weeks, in addition to whatever they had done, you know, throughout their careers in terms of diversity training, but specifically have gone through the same curriculum that was developed for the nearly 200,000 partners. And there have also been early trial runs of different groups of partners across the country. I say partners because that's what Starbucks calls their employees. So different groups of employees across the country, because some areas are rural and mostly white, some areas are rural and mostly Black and Latino, they're suburban, they're urban areas. Starbucks is in 8,000 places, and so the context is different. And so it's been important for the company to do some trial runs in these different areas to see how the training has gone. And as anyone who has ever had what I think is the privilege to stop and focus on these core questions of identity can attest to, this time spent in fellowship with other human beings, thinking about what makes us human, what connects us and what divides us, can be really quite profound.
Having covered this and having lived many of these experiences, I think there's a sort of suspicion around this notion of quote unquote implicit bias. And I want to play you guys a call that we got.
Implicit bias doesn't exist. The only bias is in the recipient's mind. They believe they're being, someone is biased against them, but it's just on them.
Paul, your thoughts on that?
So some of our ideas about race are unconscious. If you notice an African-American man walking behind you in the street, you may feel more anxious. You don't feel like you're a racist. You may not even be aware that you're having these feelings. I think the value of implicit bias is it makes people less defensive when they talk about race. If, like the song says, everybody's a little bit racist, then maybe we shouldn't feel that stigmatized when we acknowledge our own sometimes complicated feelings about race. It also gets us away from thinking about racism as only the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis marching in Charlottesville. If we know that that nice barista at our local coffee shop has some baggage, I think that that helps us think about the way race actually works. Another concern I have is that implicit bias can sound less harmful than explicit. But the effects on people of color can be just as bad. So I'm a tall, dark, Black dude, and implicit bias makes the police more likely to see my cell phone as a gun. And so it has the same kinds of consequences, whether it's implicit or explicit.
And one of the things I've, you know, in my work in this space, I've been surprised by is why there's so much difficulty or resistance or lack of context around race in America today, where even things like videos that we're seeing don't necessarily connect. Are we seeing a change? Are more Americans becoming more aware of these quote unquote implicit biases, or are we still resistant to recognizing that?
I think this is a really important question. First of all, we are seeing a moment for the past 5 years of rising racial consciousness among people of color, I will say, right? Not everybody was raised to see the world through this lens, even if they come from families of color, and also white Americans. I think we can't downplay how much more this is a conversation in our media, how much more you have interest in these questions of equity and inclusion and diversity from all corners of our society, the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement to protect immigrants in this country have changed public consciousness. Importantly, that video in Philadelphia was recorded by a white person and shared outrage of white customers in the store, and they immediately saw it as an issue of police and racial bias. So this is definitely, we are at a moment of a heightened racial consciousness, and there's been great progress that has been made in terms of a culture shift because of it. That said, there is a cultivated narrative that puts the blame for disparities on people of color, that says that racist stereotypes like African Americans are dangerous and Muslims are terrorists and immigrants are criminals are not stereotypes, but they're rather common sense. And those negative narratives serve a political and an economic purpose to divide working and middle class people of different races from one another and put in office a very, very fringe political agenda. That's what we see today, obviously. But when our number one rated cable news network has those kinds of reverse racism, it's the people who are talking about racism who are actually the racists, while they traffic in stereotypes from sun up to sundown, you have to recognize that people like the caller that we heard are being fed on a daily basis the idea that racism is all in the heads of people of color, and people of color are trying to somehow use claims of racism to their own personal advantage, when we know that racism is as real and as pervasive in this society as virtually any other force, and it must be addressed wholeheartedly.
And I'm curious about what your thoughts are on whether this focus on Starbucks needs to be on Starbucks. I've also seen folks who say, well, you know what, just frequent Black-owned coffee shops and put your dollars elsewhere. Do you agree?
I think that everybody has a responsibility for addressing bias. And for Starbucks, it's just good customer service. It's the way that it should do business. So I'm actually surprised to hear that wonderful people like Heather and Brian Stevenson and Cheryl Lynn Eiffel are doing this for free, pro bono. I mean, if Starbucks found out that one of its shops had some toxic waste, they would call someone to clean it up. And that's the cost of doing business. And the reason I think it's important to understand it as a business practice is it shouldn't be like this day is kind of like the equivalent of Martin Luther King Day or Black History Month, a time when we sing Kumbaya and think seriously about race and then move on. There are going to be issues at Starbucks tomorrow and the next day. And again, I think we have to think of those in a same way that we think of other kinds of business problems. Beyond and outside of Starbucks, though, there's also a structural problem with the way that society responds. So it's not just that people are biased. It's that there's a whole state apparatus that responds. So anyone can call 911 and get people with guns and the power to arrest to respond to their bias. And I guess the other kind of unfortunate thing is it's not just white folks who have these kinds of biases. We all do. And so, yes, we should frequent African-American and Latino-owned coffee shops, but that's not going to by itself solve the problem any more than hiring more Black police officers makes things better for Black folks on the streets.
So do you think it's too idealistic this Starbucks approach, or do you think this might get other companies to step up to the plate?
I think it's a very important first step. Mad props to Starbucks for taking responsibility, but it's just that. It's a first step.
Heather McGee is the president of Demos, a progressive think tank, and an advisor to Starbucks on their anti-bias training. And Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University, a former prosecutor, and the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thank you so much for being with me today.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, we have an assignment for you, some homework. Head to thetakeaway.org/bias, and we have a link there to the widely used Harvard Implicit Association Test. We want you to take one of those tests, anyone you want, and tell us what you think. Were you surprised at the results? Did you think it was a fair assessment? Were you disappointed? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, or if you're so inclined, tweet me at Tanzina Vega and tell us what you found. And we want to thank you so much for listening to us today. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow. Nearly 5,000 dead and a grim picture of mental health in Puerto Rico.
There are so many people who are anxious, who are feeling lost, who are unwilling or unable to get aid.
Suicides have skyrocketed on the island after Hurricane Maria. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we talk mental health in post-storm Puerto Rico next time on the Takeaway Podcast.